Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. By now, you've probably heard of fracking, hydraulic fracturing. The technology has spawned an oil and gas boom in the United States. Here's how it works. Companies drill deep into the ground, a mile or two down, into shale. That's a hard but porous rock with little pockets of gas or oil speckled throughout. Then they inject highly pressurized frack fluid. That is a combination of water, sand, and chemicals. And they break up the rock and release the oil and gas that way. But at what cost? That is the question we're asking today. Journalist Elizabeth Reut says we're increasingly relying on local food, but that local food is being contaminated by our pursuit of local energy. She goes on to say there's growing evidence that these two impulses toward energy and food independence may be at odds with each other. So what are the dangers of this rapidly increasing process, and how might it be impacting the health of our food supply, water systems, and ultimately our bodies and our planet? Joining us today to talk about all this is Elizabeth Reut. She's a journalist who writes about science and the environment. She recently published an article in The Nation magazine titled Fracking and the Food Supply, and she writes about farmers and ranchers affected by hydraulic fracturing. She's also the author of Bottle Mania, How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Holly.
We're also joined in studio by Adam Scow, who's the California campaign's director at Food and Water Watch. He's responsible for developing strategy for local, state, and national campaigns, and he's been actively involved in fighting fracking projects here in California. Hi, Adam.
Hello. Good morning.
Good to have you here. We're also joined on the line by Jackie Schilke, who is a livestock rancher in rural North Dakota, where fracking is an incredible boom. And Jackie, let's go ahead and start with your story, which Elizabeth wrote about in The Nation magazine. All of this information, by the way, is at yourcallradio.org. So Jackie Schilke started to notice something was wrong about 2 years ago. That was when wells for hydraulic fracturing were drilled within 5 miles of her home. And you noticed that your animals started to get sick. Tell us what happened next, Jackie, and give us a sense of what was going on.
Well, I guess, you know, at first we had no indication that there was a problem until our first dog died. And it was a small dog that was in the house all the time, a Yorkie, which had been with us since birth. And it suddenly got sick and died within a matter of days, and of course the vet had no answers for us except that it seemed to have been poisoned. And that immediately shocked me as very alarming, because we have no chemicals, no fertilizers, no poisons, anything on our property. We don't use any such thing, you know, with livestock around. And at first, you know, we thought, you know, we leaned toward possibly a pet food or some kind of contamination like that. Until, of course, my husband and I started having health problems, and it all kind of happened, you know, simultaneously. It went from my husband and I to outside animals started getting sick. We started noticing extreme fast changes in our livestock, and then I actually had several cows that died on me. And then I started, you know, my pursuit as to the cause of it, and it just became kind of a nightmare from there on, and it still is. It continues to be. I get no answers. I get very little cooperation or help.
Jackie, can you, I read, I think, in Elizabeth's article that your ranch is now surrounded by about 40 fracking wells within a three-mile radius of your house and your ranch. Can you just give us a sense of what's been happening with the boom in North Dakota? What does it look, how has it changed in the past, say, 3 to 5 years?
It is totally out of control. I mean, absolutely out of control is the words I use. I live, for instance, 24 miles in the middle of nowhere. In when we first moved out here, I mean, there were hardly a vehicle on our road. Seldom would you even see a neighbor go to town. I mean, we were a very remote area. And now I feel like I live on an interstate. The truck traffic is 24/7. It never stops. The bulldozers are constantly leveling out land. They're pulling in rigs just as fast as they can get them. It's crazy.
And
we have gone from agricultural to completely industrial.
And farmers and ranchers are getting a lot of money for these drilling rights, right?
Some are. And I guess, you know, it all depends on what you think a lot of money is. When they first tried to put the first well on our property. We didn't allow him to. We fought it because we have livestock, and I can't spare an acre of my land, was my opinion. But they offered us, you know, immediately, yeah, money, we'll pay you. And, you know, their first offer was $10,000. Well, I'm sorry, but $10,000 isn't a lot of money to me. Other people may think so. But when you have acreage and you need it to support your life, you know, 10,000 acres doesn't mean much.
But if you don't have money, you might be tempted. And even if you decide not to give drilling rights on your own land, that doesn't mean that your land isn't going to be affected by it.
No, it doesn't. Not necessarily. Most of the land here, the minerals are owned by older families who previously owned the property, and you really don't have a lot of control. You only have the surface rights, which kind of puts you in a hard position. But you can, you know, try to negotiate with these companies. And my husband was very convincing, and he did manage to keep them off of our property, which in the end, it made no difference. They just went right over the borderline of our property and drilled the well, and the end result was no better than if it would have been on our property.
And Jackie's been working with the EPA and other agencies to fight back against the oil companies fracking near her land, but she hasn't had any victories yet. Jackie, stay on the line with us, and we'll talk to you more about your own experience and open the lines for listeners to talk with you as well. Let me invite Elizabeth to join us. So can you talk a little bit about what you found in your research? How common is a story like Jackie's, and why did you begin reporting on this story in the first place, Elizabeth?
I was asked to do this story by a group called the Food and Environment Reporting Network, which is a nonprofit group that funds this sort of journalism. And so they put me onto this idea. I had read a paper by two researchers from working around in Ithaca, who did a paper collecting the case histories of a couple score farmers who had losses of domestic and livestock animals, and learned about hundreds of deaths of animals who had been accidentally or incidentally exposed to chemicals used in drilling and fracking operations. So one of these people that they put me in touch with was Jackie, and I spoke to other farmers and ranchers as well.
You there, Elizabeth?
I'm here, yes.
So you spoke with other farmers. So, but I'm trying to get at a sense of the scope of this.
Yeah, it's a really good question. We don't know the scope of it. Jackie is, it's hard to find farmers and ranchers who will talk about this for many, many reasons. Some of them have been in litigation with the fracking companies, and they've settled and signed non-disclosure agreements. Some of the ranchers are getting royalties from gas companies and don't want to bite the hand that feeds them, even though they've had trouble on their ranches. A lot of the farmers can't prove cause and effect. They didn't do any testing of their soil, water, or air before the oil and gas companies came in, so they have a very hard time making a case that these operations hurt them or their livestock or their farms.
Because the companies can say, well, those chemicals were already there.
They could say that, yeah. It's just very difficult to make these cases. There's a lot of unknowns. The fracking companies, the oil and gas companies, aren't required to reveal the chemicals that they use.
And that's because these are considered trade secrets.
Exactly. They're exempt from key statutes of a lot of federal environmental laws. Veterinarians, I learned, often don't want to talk about these issues. You can ask Jackie about this, but vets just don't want to come out and see these animals, especially in rural areas, I think. And they don't know what they're looking at. They don't know what to look for. They don't have any answers. And I talked to some vets who said that they don't really want to talk about this because they're afraid of their reputations and that other ranchers won't use them. And, you know, these are very industry-friendly communities, some of them. A lot of people are happy to have the oil and gas industry in their backyard, and they don't want their veterinarians impugning the industry. And then you've got people who don't want to talk about what's going on with their ranches because of it's their livelihood, and they don't want to impugn their herd reputation.
Right, which is something that happened to Jackie, right? You can't sell your cattle anymore because you feel ethically that you don't have the right to do that.
Correct. It's a big concern of mine, yes.
So Jackie's very honest, but I think that there are some people out there who want to keep selling their cattle, and since they don't know exactly what's going on, they're going to keep doing it until they know for sure, or as someone said in my story, until there's a real train wreck and people come looking and the hammer comes down, and then we'll find out what's going on with these animals. Another point I make is that the number of animals that have died is really trivial in the larger scheme of our food supply. You know, 97 million cattle go to slaughter in the country each year, and I by no means know of all the livestock that have died because of oil and gas operations, but, you know, it's in the hundreds, I think, not in the millions. But we don't really know. Animals that die on ranches aren't getting into our food supply, but their herd mates very likely are. The animals that can make it to the slaughterhouse, to the feedlot, and then to the slaughterhouse. But one of these problems, which Adam from Food and Water Watch can probably talk about, is that slaughterhouses aren't required to look for the residues of these chemicals in the animals. And so they're mostly focusing on pathogens and pesticides. They're not looking for contaminants that are linked with oil and gas operations.
Well, let me bring Adam into this to talk about what's happening here in California, which I think a lot of people don't understand that fracking is happening here, and it's likely to happen more and more. So we'll find out about that in just a sec. But, Adam, there's a loophole in the 2005 Energy Policy Act, which exempted oil and gas corporations from the Clean Air and Water Acts, which is kind of shocking from my perspective. Can you explain what the exemptions are and how that affects us now?
Yeah, absolutely. That was the 2005 energy bill over which Dick Cheney presided over, who was formerly on the board of Halliburton, which is one of the main companies that pioneered this high-volume fracking technology that's currently exploded all over the country. So it was exempted, I believe, from the Safe Drinking Water Act.
And the Clean Air Act.
In 2005. And so that's really let these companies get away with what they're getting away with without any liability. It's very hard to prove cause, and they don't have to comply with our basic environmental laws.
What was the rationale for that? I mean, was there...
Well, I think it's an awareness, an admission that despite what the companies say, it's quite obvious that this technology is very dirty, very polluting, and has major threats to human health, the water, and the air. And these companies and their vice president were looking to massively expand fracking, knew there would be problems, and would like to have this exemption, this liability from our nation's laws so they can be free from financial damage. I'm sure that's one of the reasons. And since then...
But was another reason the fact that we were trying to get away from energy dependence on foreign oil supplies?
Not necessarily. That is a common talking point from the oil and gas industry and their politicians. However, at the rate of oil consumption in this country, we're nowhere near a point of getting off imported oil. Take a look at California. There's estimated 15 billion barrels of oil in the Monterey Shale under the ground between San Francisco and Los Angeles. Now, that sounds like a lot of oil, but nationwide, that's only 3 or 4 years of our energy supply. There's no guarantee that domestic oil and gas production is for domestic use anyways. These are on international markets. They will go to where the highest price is. These companies are multinationals. So it's really a talking point that's not based in truth.
So can you give us a sense of the scope of what's happening here in California? And is it increasing? Is it likely to increase? As my understanding is, we have no fracking state laws on fracking.
That's right. Our state government doesn't even require oil companies to tell them if they're fracking or require a permit for it. California is historically an oil state. I think we've recently been surpassed by North Dakota because of the big oil boom there. However, with the Monterey Shale now in play because of fracking technologies, previously it's very hard to extract that oil, and now the fracking with a high volume of water and chemicals and pressure has made that oil now possibly accessible. We are looking at another big oil boom in California should we allow that to happen.
So what's the difference? So in the Northeast, they're fracking for natural gas for the most part. In California, we're mostly fracking for oil. What's the difference between those two?
There's not a big difference with the processes. Fracking is a process of injecting water, chemicals, and sand at high pressure to blow up the rock. You can do it for gas or you can do it for oil. And in California, we do it for both, actually. In the Sacramento Valley, Venoco, a Colorado corporation, has fracked about a dozen wells for natural gas near the Sacramento River in Sutter County. And they're also fracking for oil offshore Santa Barbara, in Ventura County and Kern County. And the other big player is Occidental Oil and Gas Company based in Los Angeles. Those are the two big companies fracking in California and wanting to expand those operations.
And I heard, we did a story on fracking in California about a year ago, and the Western States Petroleum Association said, hey, look, we've been doing this for 50, 60 years. It's not dangerous. If it were, you'd know it.
Again, a common talking point from the oil and gas industry that has a vested interest in making billions of dollars off fracking California. So there's no, as we know, there's no regulations. We can't really, we have to take what they say with a grain of salt. There's no question that fracking technology has changed, expanded, become much more intensive in the last 20 years, hence the recent exemptions in law. And it is slated for massive expansion. So the state has really let these companies do whatever they want. They don't even force them to disclose where and when they're fracking. And because of these severe threats to our water, our air, which are already compromised in California, some of these places where they want to frack in California already have the worst air quality on record, already have major groundwater contamination pollution problems from agriculture and defense industry legacies. So we're not in any position to be able to handle or deal with fracking pollution.
And that's Adam Scow. He's California Campaigns Director with Food and Water Watch. He organizes around fracking in California and is against it. We're also joined online by Jackie Schilke, who's a rancher in North Dakota who's been severely affected by fracking, and Elizabeth Reut, who's a health and environmental reporter and author of the Nation magazine article, Fracking the Food Supply. We'll put a link to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. You can also add information there. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call, and I want to invite listeners, especially those who are living near the Monterey Shale, to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. New York has a moratorium on fracking. Should there be a temporary moratorium in California until we better understand the effects? 866-798-8255. Were you aware that we do frack in California? What are your questions about how fracking may be affecting your food, your water, or your health? And if you use gas to power your car like I do, how do you look at these environmental issues? How are you changing your own life to deal with this? And what dialogue can we in California have with people like Sandra in New York and Jackie in North Dakota about what's happening? Is this just a not in my backyard sort of an issue? 866-798-8255, or you can email us at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to, I have a bunch of web comments. Yvonne says, Ivan says, I pick food supply over gasoline, or do people in the oil industry drink oil for breakfast? Muriel says, for a good movie to see, A Land Out of Time. And let's go to Warren in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Warren. Welcome to your call.
Ah, thank you.
I heard that you found us on Facebook.
I mean, there's been a lot of bashing and whatnot on fracking, and I understand it because, you know, I live Louisville's quite close to Ohio, where they do a bit of fracking there as well. And you know, I've seen the documentaries and whatnot. But I mean, also, you know, there are some pluses to fracking. I mean, you know, it's one of the fastest growing energy sources. But then again, you know, there's also the downside. I have to agree with some of the people that, I mean, it's been shown in those documentaries. I can't remember the name of it. They did have a big one where it's been getting into the drinking water and whatnot. And also, you know, it is a very wasteful source for water because fracking on an average can take about 5 million gallons of water in the process of it. I have a family in the natural resource. So some of the stuff I've known about
So, Warren, let me ask you a question. You were talking about there's pros and cons. Obviously, the pros are that people are getting jobs and getting money and being able to make a living. On the other hand, if this is going to permanently contaminate the food and water supply, I mean, how are you weighing that?
That is a good question, how I'm weighing that. I mean, it definitely is just, you know, you got to pick the lesser of two evils. Which side do you want to go with? You know, which it's very hard on this kind of thing to figure out which one outweighs the other, the pros or the cons, because they both do have a very high number. But then again, you know, they both have downsides.
All right, let me throw that to our panel, Warren. Thank you for calling us. And I want to read something that the Organic Consumer Association said. With hundreds of thousands of fracking wells and waste injection sites in the U.S., it's likely that our food supply already contains water, plants, and animals, meat, contaminated with fracking chemicals. So as you guys are listening to people like Warren and a lot of people that I'm sure you talk to, Elizabeth, people who are benefiting from this boom, and not just large companies, but farmers and ranchers and people getting jobs for the first time in a few years, how do you talk to people about these sort of how you balance the economic concerns with the environmental and health concerns? Anybody, Adam, Elizabeth, Jackie? How do you talk to people about this?
I don't talk to people about it because I'm a reporter. I don't do advocacy work. But I listen to what they say, and I hear people talking about short-term benefits versus these long-term harms. The big point that I wanted to make in my story is that there's so much that we don't know for all those reasons I was talking about earlier, and that this oil and gas are going to be in the ground for a long time. And why not pull back and do these studies? We have had no long-term peer-reviewed studies of the health impacts of oil and gas drilling operations. We don't know how these chemicals move through the plants. Are they moving into plants, and at what levels, and can these levels hurt us? What are the interactions between these different chemicals that are naturally occurring in the ground but we're pulling up and that we're pushing down into the ground and that then come up? How long will the effects last? What are the clear times? There are just so many things that we don't really know, and there's a lot of fear, and there's some hysteria and exaggeration. And if I could say anything, it would be it's to emphasize this need to fund these studies, these independent, peer-reviewed, long-term studies, and get the answers before we put so much at risk. It is really hard to clean up an aquifer, and we've seen what happens with over time with low levels of contaminants from other industrial sites, from Tom's River to Love Canal to, on and on.
All right, let me get a final thought from Adam before we go to a break, and then we'll get to a lot more of your calls. Go ahead, Adam.
Well, absolutely, and definitely a need for long-term studies, independent studies in particular, because most of the studies out there are paid for by the oil and gas industry, and they say everything's fine. However, what we're seeing now from new studies from the University of Colorado, School of Public Health, and Cornell University, is that there are serious problems with fracking, even in its limited history of the last 10, 15 years. The previous promises that it was somehow a clean energy, natural gas, has proven to be totally false. When you look at the entire process, it's just as polluting as coal. When you look at the health contaminants, the volatile organic compounds, the asthma and health problems in counties in Colorado that are being heavily fracked, it's very obscene, and we're seeing high levels of methane that people are breathing and becoming literally quite sick. And then we're hearing what's happening with the farmers and the animals. So it's simply just not worth it.
And in a recent article from Harper's Magazine, it says that there were at least 1,100 spills in North Dakota's stretch of the Bakken during 2011. So 2 years ago, I think that was the latest data that they had. And those are just mistakes, spills. So you were talking about fracking and the effects on our food and water, and we're asking the question as to whether or not we should put in play the precautionary principle and really understand what's happening before we dump so many chemicals into our land and water. We're speaking with Adam Scow, who's California Campaign's director with Food and Water Watch, Elizabeth Reut, who's a health and environmental reporter and author of the Nation magazine article, Fracking the Food Supply, and we're joined by Jackie Schilke, who's a rancher in North Dakota, who told us the story of how her animals and her own health have been affected by all of the fracking that's happening in North Dakota. We have full lines, but I'll give out the number after we go to a short break. We have all of this information at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
Listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. If you have a perspective that you think has not been heard in today's discussion, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email a question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up. Speaking of which, tomorrow we will mark the 50th anniversary of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. So how far have we come in the 5 decades since Friedan's original critique? What defines progress for women? A lot of women's experiences were not represented in Friedan's book. So if you read it in the 60s, how did it affect you? And what does it mean to talk about women's issues today? Friday, of course, is our weekly media roundtable, and we'll speak with journalists about the week's news. Today, we're talking about how is fracking affecting our food and water supply. We are joined by Adam Scow, who's the California Campaigns Director at Food and Water Watch, and he's looking at what's happening here in California. We're also joined by journalist Elizabeth Reut, who says there's growing evidence that the two impulses toward energy and food independence may be at odds with each other. And Elizabeth, thank you for joining us. I know that you had to go, so we will say goodbye to you. And we're also joined by North Dakota rancher Jackie Schilke, who says her animals dropped dead on her, and her own health began to a steep decline after fracking began on her land in North Dakota. So what do we need to know about the effects of hydraulic fracturing on our food and water? I will give out the number again. You can write it down. We have full lines right now, though. It's 866-798-TALK. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And you can leave comments and information at yourcallradio.org. The Organic Consumers Association is going to be holding a national summit to stop the frack attack in Dallas, Texas on March 2nd through 4th. And we'll put information at yourcallradio.org. We're now joined also by Sandra Steingraber, who's the founder of New Yorkers Against Fracking. She's an authority on the environmental links to cancer and human health, and she's the author of Raising Elijah, Protecting Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, Ellie.
Thank you for joining us. So you say that hydrofracking is the single largest environmental threat to children's health. Explain why you say that.
Well, hydrofracking is one of four forms of extreme energy extraction, the others being tar sands, deep-sea oil drilling, and mountaintop removal. They're all terrible for the climate. In terms of public health, for massive amounts of people, fracking is the one in which it unrolls right in our communities where people live, work, and go to school. And so fracking is an activity that uses our land as factory floor. And as soon as the drill goes into the shale, not only do bubbles of methane come up, that's what natural gas is, but there are many other hydrocarbons that are trapped in the shale, and basically we're taking the lid off of Pandora's box, or maybe, if you will, fracturing the lid on Pandora's box. So out from that hole come things like benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and other harmful substances. And where I live in upstate New York, our bedrock also contains radon and radium. So there's a radioactive issue as well. And, of course, there are toxic chemicals added to the water that's used as a club to shatter the shale, and those also raise health risks. So for many pathways, both water and air, and because fracking occurs next to our homes and next to children's schools, it raises unique threats to public health. And then, of course, food being one. Drilling and fracking operations along with oil exploration is now, according to Randy Udall, the number one land use in the United States. So we're planting less wheat and corn than we are leasing land for fossil fuel extraction. And so we're competing with our food system, with land use, for a form of fossils versus food to feed ourselves.
And Sandra, I want to ask you about how you achieved the moratorium in New York. But before I do that, water is a huge, huge issue here. You need to pump a lot of water into these wells. There's now competition for water in a lot of these areas where fracking is happening. It's a big issue here in California already, water without fracking. My understanding is that 70% of the liquid that goes down into a borehole eventually comes up and it's all contaminated. What happens to that water, and how is this going to affect the water supply, Adam?
Well, historically, some of that wastewater that's come up has been dumped into pits, unlined pits, and we're supposed to be phasing that out now. However, the enforcement of our laws.
But do you have to dispose of this water? Is there any way to clean it up?
There is a growing technological interest in figuring out if that can be done. The question on that is unclear. This is some pretty nasty chemicals. We're talking about 500 chemicals, some of which are known to cause cancer. Oftentimes what happens is the wastewater is reinjected into wells underground, into pits deep underground, and they just leave them there. And then we know concrete wells fail over time. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. The industry knows this, especially right after the frack job. So there's a risk of contamination immediately because of the high pressure and all the water and chemicals escaping into aquifers, into the soil, and into the air that we breathe. And this is increasingly a concern on the Central Valley, which is one of the most productive, if not the most productive, agricultural region on the face of the earth. It is a breadbasket for the world, as well as much of the country. And, of course, here with our local food movement in the Bay Area, this is a major concern. So we want to protect our food, our farmers, and our water.
Well, let's find out how they did get the moratorium in New York in just a minute. I want to go to another caller because we have a lot of people on the line that want to talk to you all. Judy in Monterey, welcome to your call. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for this excellent program. In December, the Bureau for Land Management just leased 16,000 acres more in South County, in San Benito, in Fresno County, and Monterey County. We're the largest producer of grapes, actually, in California. It doesn't seem that way, but there are a lot of vineyards down there. People are concerned. And so a lot of us have been coming interested and gone on the website of the Department of Conservation in California. There's the Division of, it's under the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources.
Dogger.
And they have these new draft regulations that are really shocking. I mean, they seem to be putting in protections, but there's very little enforcement. It relies on the people actually in the who are doing the wells to once a month sort of identify if there's a problem, and if there's a medical emergency, then you know, the holder of the information withheld is a trade secret. She'll immediately disclose the information to the health professional. I mean, how does somebody know that the reason they're not, you know, well is because of fracking? How you get in touch?
Right.
It's really ludicrous, but I just wanted to say one thing in addition, is that in Washington, Hanford's nuclear power plant, there are now cracks and leaks and problems there. And if we had put in place the precautionary principle, a lot of these nuclear power plants wouldn't have passed the test. And final thing is that California just passed Proposition, I think it was 39. There will be some money coming from that for clean energy and energy renewal. And I think that if we had in place in California the oil, what do they call that, tax on oil drilling, that could also be put for clean energy sources, renewable energy, which would be what we need in place of any of this fracking. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Judy. Adam wants to respond to you, and then I want to hear from Sandra how they achieved a moratorium, a temporary moratorium in New York. Go ahead, Adam.
Well, absolutely. All great points there. And absolutely, the State Department of Division of Geothermal and Gas Resources, Dogger. I call them Dodger because what they mostly do is get out of the way and let the oil and gas companies do whatever they want. These regulations are really a red herring. There's really no safe way to frack. And so that there's a fantasy, it's a fairy tale that there's going to be some safe fracking that the industry is selling the people of California through massive television commercials. You're starting to see them now all over the state. We know pollution happens all the time. It's not the exception. It is the norm. So the simple disclosure of some of the chemicals, advance notice 10, 20, 30 days, does not deal with the problem. It does not prevent contamination of the food and water and air supply. So it's really a joke. And the state is woefully behind on protecting our water and food supply. So the solution of fracking, and we've been talking about it, is to ban it. That is really the best way to deal with it. And I'm glad you brought in the part about clean energy, because California there, again, is woefully behind on building our clean energy economy. We have enormous solar and wind potential that we're not tapping, and it needs to be tapped eventually. So the time to do it is now.
Thanks for that. Adam Scow is California Campaigns Director at Food and Water Watch. And let's go back to Sandra and find out how you got a moratorium in New York, how it works, and basically what was the battle to do that?
Sure. Well, I think it was achieved as anything anything is. You know, it's the same way we got DDT banned and lead paint banned and slavery abolished and so forth, and women won the right to vote. It took a citizen uprising, and it took citizens working together with scientists to point out that fracking first and asking questions later risks repeating a terrible script in which lots of people are harmed in ways that are unfixable. And, of course, once you shatter the bedrock of our nation and toxic substances and vapors start flowing and rising out of it, there's no fixing that. It's not even like Deep Sea Horizon where eventually you can go in and plug the hole. So we're talking about creating a pipeline of unstoppable consequences with fracking. And so in New York, we've happily taken a different approach, and I'm actually talking to you from the Capitol building itself here in Albany, where we just gave a press conference thanking Governor Cuomo for keeping his foot on the brake until we can move forward with real comprehensive health studies and health investigations of fracking. Now, I'm convinced as a biologist and somebody who's studied the health effects of fracking now for 2 years that if, even though the data are just beginning to come in, and they're in some cases very troubling data, in some cases affecting, you know, newborn infants, born to pregnant women who live near drilling and fracking operations, but we mostly have a vast pool of ignorance. But for all the reasons that Adam explained, it's clear to me that fracking cannot be done safely. You know, cement is not immortal. Sooner or later, cement well casings crack, they crumble, they shrink in ways that open portals of contamination between a very toxic deep geological strata and our drinking aquifers that lie above. And that's, you know, just one of many reasons that makes fracking the wrong way to go. Additionally, of course, we're only talking about 5 to 14 years of gas at the most. So by the time my own kids are my age, the gas will be gone, the jobs will be gone, the revenue will be gone, we will burn through the gas, and what they'll be left with is a toxic mess. So clearly not the way to go. And in New York so far, wiser heads have prevailed, but it's been an intense battle. It has required scientists to work together with grassroots activists. 7,000 of us now have taken a pledge to resist fracking in New York, where we've actually taken a solemn vow to engage in peaceful, nonviolent acts of protest, and for some of us that will include civil disobedience, should the governor move forward on fracking. We have artists who are standing with us who can help us imagine an alternative future, most notably Yoko Ono. We just submitted a letter today to Governor Cuomo signed by Artists Against Fracking and also by Gloria Steinem and other leading thinkers here in New York.
And so it's all
together, you know, all hands on deck kind of movement. But I would say it is a citizen uprising.
A citizen uprising. That's Sandra Steingraber, who's founder of New Yorkers Against Fracking, and she's a biologist and author of Raising Elijah. Adam, so what are you learning? I want to go back to more calls because we've got a ton of calls, but what are we in California learning from activists in places like New York?
Well, New York's doing a great job. New Yorkers Against Fracking and Sandra are setting the example for how to fight fracking, and we're going to try to do the same thing here in California. We're working with three legislators in Southern California to get legislation introduced to put a moratorium on fracking in California. We have a big fight. California is historically an oil state, so it makes our fight a little bit harder. We also have a governor who is currently on the side of the oil and gas industry. In fact, he fired the former head of Dogger because the industry didn't like her because she was just trying to enforce some basic laws, and he has told several business councils that he's proud he did that because oil production is now up. So we got our work cut out for us. We have a petition to Governor Brown. We're almost at 100,000 signatures, and we want to get that up to 200.5 million in these coming years.
And are you specifying fracking, or are you against all oil drilling?
We're specifying fracking because it is a specifically disgusting practice that is being used to extract the oil, but it is fracking where the campaign is to ban fracking in California.
And that's Adam Scow, and one of the things that he wrote recently in an article is fracking uses and produces millions of gallons of toxic wastewater that is difficult to dispose of safely. There have been thousands of cases nationwide of water contamination near drilling sites from surface leaks and spills. There are no guarantees that the same thing couldn't happen to any of the wells being fracked near the Sacramento River. Let's go to Ula in Ohio. Welcome to your call. Hi, Ula.
Hello. I'm actually in New York. My parents have a farm in Meredith, New York, and we're concerned about fracking's impact on our grasslands.
All the states seem the same from here out west. Sorry. Go ahead, Ula.
No problem. I just we're concerned about fracking's impact on our water and grasslands. We raise grass-fed beef and lamb, and there has been some studies conducted that have linked cattle deaths and poisonings to fracking. And the organic and pasture-based farming is becoming, like, really important in upstate New York, and local food is starting to grow, and there's all this excitement around it. And it's so sad that we have this big threat happening just while we're building, you know, the food system back, and a lot of family farms are starting to make money again and things like that, and fracking really is a direct threat to that.
Well, it sounds like you've mobilized really well in New York. Jackie, so you're listening to what's happening around the country. How does that feel to you in North Dakota? Are there any budding movements to unite farmers to sign a pledge to really look at this? Are there big studies happening?
Unfortunately, not so much within our state. I'm one of the few that is collecting data and has been trying to work with the doctors and the different organizations such as the EPA and the ATSDR. But the grass-fed livestock, that is a huge problem. What I have found with my research and what's happened on our property is it's not just the water and it's not just limited to your property. Something can be happening 5 or 10 miles away, and it's going to affect your livestock either through the air or the soil or migration or somebody dumping illegally. I mean, there are so many invariables and so many unknowns. As far as help, when you need it, when your livestock starts showing problems or health problems, it's almost virtually impossible. We've requested chemical information and we've been denied. We've requested help from the state. We're laughed at. You know, it's a serious, serious problem. And a lot of the people in our area just don't fight it. They've just sold their livestock. They've gotten out of the livestock business. And that is going to be devastating in the future. People don't realize that without these small herds of cattle, you know, it's already starting to affect the feedlots in the other states such as Iowa and Ohio, and everywhere is going to be affected.
Jackie Schilke is a livestock rancher in rural North Dakota who's been severely affected, both her own health and the health of her animals in North Dakota, because of fracking, she thinks. And Adam, I want to get to more calls, but how can consumers know if the food that they're buying at a store or a restaurant was raised near a fracking well? How do we know that what we're eating is safe?
Well, there's really no way to know at this point, and, you know, just to put my food hat on, Food and Water Watch does a lot of work to protect family farmers and livestock producers who are going through tough times economically. And we know through increasing consolidation of the slaughterhouse business, we're looking at four companies with Cargill at the top, where all this cattle is mixed together and processed together. And there's already some health concerns about what goes on there. And then let's add in some fracking fluids to the mix, and that's just going to make things worse. So it's a major concern. And it's unfortunate that oil and gas industry and their politicians are taking advantage of the problem in our food system and making things worse for our farmers.
So you're listening to your call. I'm Holly Kernan, and let's take a few calls back to back and then get responses from all of you. Let's go first to David in Oakland. Hi, David. Can you please be brief?
Yes, I'll be very brief. Some time ago, I saw reports in coming from Switzerland regarding fracking, which was causing an increase in earthquakes there, and they put a stop to the whole process immediately because of it. I believe I'm correct in this. One can obviously extrapolate from this. California is known to have earthquakes. The U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey has published maps, which are publicly available, about the zones of fracture down through the entire Salinas-Sacramento Valley area where this is going on. I see this as a time bomb. I don't know anything, sealing wells, et cetera, that could possibly stand against the, say, the 100-year or even the 1,000-year earthquake.
Okay, so, David, you want to know about the potential effect in California of fracking on earthquake safety?
Yeah, that's okay. Basically that, but the extrapolation to the possibilities of ever greater pollution are just obvious.
Yeah, thank you so
and
much
sure.
for calling. I'm going to go now to Kevin in Felton. We're going to take all these calls back-to-back and then get some response. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I work with the Sierra Club, and we're we're sponsoring a case against the BLM leases in Fresno, Monterey, and San Benito counties. And I just wanted to address the question of, you know, the oil industry is claiming that they've been fracking for 50 or 80 years, but that's really not true. What they have now is a really amazing new technology where they send down a single large diameter vertical bore, and from that hole they can then send out multiple horizontal bores in various directions as much as 2 miles deep, and each of those bores can go for a couple of miles in a different direction. So a single well can access a large area of terrain depending on the choices made by the drilling company. And the amount of water it takes to bust apart this rock,
I need you to be brief here.
High pressure to open up faults in rock.
Great. Okay, so thank you so much. And you're working against a lease of Bureau of Land Management. Let's also go to Larry in Santa Cruz, and then we'll get some responses. Larry, I need you to be brief, please.
Okay, hey, the first time on the air, I'm very nervous.
Oh, don't be nervous. Thank you for joining us.
There's a movie I saw on Access TV called Frack Nation. I don't know if anybody has heard about that, but it seems to be, it's a kind of insidious movie. It comes across as very objective and very low-keyed, but it is definitely pro-fracking once you get to the end of the movie and they lay out their conclusions and all the supposedly objective and academic support of fracking and how harmless it is to the environment. So
interesting. Well, thank you so much for calling. Let me get a response. Let's start with Adam. David spoke about earthquake risks and called it a time bomb. Kevin is talking about what's changing now. They say the oil industry says that they've been fracking for decades, and so it's safe. And Larry wants to know if you've all heard of Frack Nation and kind of this this attempt to get a counter-narrative out about fracking. And then I have some good emails that I'd like to read. Go ahead,
Adam. Yeah, well, I'll start backwards. Frack Nation is an oil and gas puff film. No need to see it to celebrate their financial success and to pretend everything's fine. Earthquakes, as if everything we were talking about wasn't bad enough. Yes, fracking is linked with earthquakes. United States Geological Survey and the Canadian government have both found direct correlation between increased fracking activity and earthquakes. Interestingly enough, they think it's the wastewater disposal deep underground that destabilizes the fault. And so in places like Ohio, not known for its earthquake activity, we've seen a tripling of earthquakes in the Midwest. Of course, California is earthquake country. They're actually fracking in the middle of Los Angeles in the Inglewood oil field. It's the nation's largest urban oil field, and people's homes are literally cracking apart, and the land is subsiding. And of course, they're the ones who have to pay and deal with the damage, and the oil companies aren't liable for anything. The BLM leases are federal leases, and congrats to Kevin and his partners for working to stop that. He's absolutely right. The oil companies claim that fracking has been going on forever is just false, and they cannot be trusted.
So I got two emails here, and we're really running out of time. Let me get to you, Sandra. So one email says, I'm an oil and gas royalty owner. How can I find out if the money I'm receiving is made by fracking? And then another email, please ask about the recent studies that reveal that 20% of the gases like methane leak into the air due to fracking and up to 50% of natural gas leakage after the well is complete. These leaked gases then start to double and triple, glazing the atmosphere, at which melting more ice and frozen tundra. Sorry, this is a little hard to read. All right, let me get some final thoughts from you, Sandra. And if somebody has a lease on their oil, how can they find out what's being done with that land?
Okay, well, let's see if I can be as eloquent as Adam. It gives me a chance to publicly thank you, Adam. Food and Water Watch has done some amazingly wonderful things across the country, and I'm so proud that my little coalition here in New York is against fracking, that Food and Water Watch is one of our premier coalition members. So let's see. Let me take the question about methane first. So, yes, methane leaks from fracking operations are endemic, and they're bigger than we have previously appreciated. The problem with that, of course, is that methane is a very powerful climate killer. It is more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Depending on the time frame, it's 30 to 100 times more powerful. It can trap more heat. And so as methane, which is natural gas, leaks from the well site, leaks from the distribution system, all the way up to the moment we turn on our stove to make our tea kettle whistle, we are loading up the atmosphere with methane. And so it looks now, from the data we have available to us, that fracked gas is at least, from shale, is at least as big a climate destroyer as coal and maybe worse.
And now, Senator, we only have like 30 seconds left.
Okay. So as for the water use in fracking, to put a finer point on what Adam said, we're actually making water disappear from the hydrologic cycle, right? We're actually shoving it into deep geological strata. Half of it comes back and is permanently contaminated. There is no technology to turn it into fresh drinkable water. And the other half, then, it remains deeply deeply entombed in deep geological strata, and it's just gone. So given that we only 1% of the world's water is available to us as fresh drinkable water, we're making it disappear. And that, to my way of thinking, is just an obscenity.
And just a final question for Adam, and we really only have a couple of seconds here. How do we avoid falling into this kind of well-informed futility, this sense that the problems are so big, bigger than our ability to solve them?
Well, we're going to be the ones who solve them. Obviously, the politicians are not going to solve them. Most of them are going along with the oil and gas industry, so folks need to come join us, Food and Water Watch /California. Sign the petition, get involved. We need to get all of our state legislators, our assembly members, our state senators, our local electeds, like they've done in New York, building a very impressive groundswell movement to get fracking banned in California. So that's what it's going to take. We're going to have to decide to solve the problem.
And if somebody is an oil and gas royalty owner, is there a way for them to find out what's happening on their land?
Well, we mostly know that increasingly, as the easy-to-get oil and gas is gone, an increasing percentage of our oil and gas comes from fracking. Whether it's fracked gas or not, the time is really now to divest from fossil fuels.
And that's... Okay, so you're saying the answer is to divest. That's Dr. Sandra Steingraber. She's the founder of New Yorkers Against Fracking. We're also joined by Adam Scow, who's California Campaigns Director with Food and Water Watch. Jackie Schilke is a rancher in North Dakota. And we were also joined by Elizabeth Reut, who's a reporter for The Nation magazine. We have links to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. You can also place comments and information there for us. Thanks to everybody who joined us. I am so sorry we couldn't get to everybody. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How far have we come since the publication of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique 50 years ago? On the Next Year Call, we'll have a conversation about the impact of Friedan's groundbreaking book on generations of women. It's credited with igniting the second wave of the feminist movement of the 1960s. So what has changed since then? Join us live at 10 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. What are women's issues today? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.